Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, 9.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 22nd. Well, kids who attend the traditional brick-and-mortar schools in Wisconsin will need their boots on to trudge through another dumping of snow across much of the state yesterday and overnight. Looks like at least a half a foot in my driveway in Madison, so give yourself some extra time to shovel out and drive in this morning. Kids, on the other hand, who get their instruction through virtual schools through the internet don't have the weather to contend with this morning, but face a question about the future of virtual schools altogether. In December, there was an appeals court ruling that found Wisconsin's virtual schools were violating state laws. And this week, tomorrow, an assembly panel is supposed to take up a bill that would let virtual schools continue to operate. There is a competing bill in the state Senate that is supported by the state's largest teachers union, but opposed by many of the parents who have kids attending virtual schools. We're going to talk about virtual schools, the legality of virtual schools, the assembly and Senate bills dealing with virtual schools, and the educational merits or demerits of virtual schools with a guest education professor. And we will welcome your questions and comments for him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send your question or comment via email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Steve Correa, an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and one of our go-to experts when educational policy is in the news. Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Professor Correa, exactly what is a virtual school?
Well, I think a virtual school, a good way to think about this is that today virtual schools are primarily online. They're web-based, very technologically advanced method of delivering instruction to anybody at any age. This particular issue deals with children K-12 within the Wisconsin public system, but of course instruction can be delivered to anybody at practically any age, so there's nothing new about that. The controversy has sprung up with children between the age, you know, K-12, and that's why we're talking about this today.
Yeah. How many of these virtual schools teaching K-12 students are there in Wisconsin?
Well, my research shows that there's probably about 16 to a dozen and a half independent virtual schools, and then something around 4 to 6 consortiums of virtual schools that exist. One with the wonderful name of the Jedi Virtual School, which is just wonderful, and Starfleet Academy may be coming out with one too.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm sure that catches some people's eye. So there's lots of different versions of these.
Yeah, so why was the concept of the virtual school in the courts in Wisconsin?
Well, the first court cases happened back in the early 2000s, and that was when the WEAC and sort of DPI, but not exactly, but they signed on at least to help help the court to understand some of the issues involved, sued the Appleton Virtual School. And there was a challenge to their legitimacy, and that case was dismissed. However, this case, the most recent one that was in front of the courts, ruled that virtual schools cannot operate in terms of their enrolling students outside of their district. It's a charter school. And then the funding mechanism they decided was not proper. And then third, they decided that the instruction is primarily, this is what the court said, is primarily directed from the parents who are not certified teachers and not just a delivery of instruction. They said that the curriculum was delivered, but the parents were doing the instruction. So the issue was whether a licensed teacher was actually doing the instruction. And the court ruled, in reality, they ruled that parents were doing the instruction, non-licensed instructors. And, of course, you have a rub because this is state money, and state regulations require that state-certified instructors provide that type of instruction.
All right. So then now we have a bill in the Assembly and a bill in the Senate dealing with virtual schools. They are different. Tell us the difference. What is the Assembly proposing to do about this?
Yes, you're right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, anybody that's taken a high school civics course probably remembers that we often have conference committees that try to work out compromises mm-hmm. between the two. These are very uncompromisable. I think I just made up that word.
Okay.
These bills deal with are diametrically opposed to each other. The Assembly bill frees schools, virtual schools, from a lot of these regulations. In essence, what they try to do is they say, this is a new way to deliver instruction. We have to recognize this new technology, and we have to take the shackles off this out-of-district enrollment. Likewise, this instruction is delivered in a relatively new way, and the instruction really is by certified teachers. It's just in a way that we don't necessarily have a clear way to quantify or to be able to measure. And lastly, they say that these districts need to have more flexibility in providing this instruction. The Senate bill is much more traditional, and what it tries to do, it stipulates that funding has to be constrained. The existing models continue to exist. It offers a small little window of some opportunity for some flexibility with funding, and it caps it at about 50% of what that individual student carries with them on their head, their dollar amount for instruction. So it would cap it at about $2,000, $2,500. And frankly, a lot of virtual schools could not afford to operate with that small of financial support. So the Senate bill, in essence, kills it, except for perhaps local versions of that, certainly not statewide.
And I'm sorry, the Senate bill does what?
The Senate bill would really put the kibosh on statewide virtual schools funded by the state of Wisconsin. So the Appleton School, some of the other virtual high schools would cease to exist because it really controls and constrains very much the way that they deliver instruction and the way that that instruction is funded. So it's sort of a keep the status quo, keep the court ruling out of the Senate bill. The Assembly bill is much broader, takes some of those constraints off, and allows virtual schools to really operate as they are, and maybe even with a little bit more flexibility. So two very different ways to go about it.
Yeah, we're going to check weather, and then we'll continue talking about virtual schools, the legislation from both the Assembly and the Senate dealing with virtual schools, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Tuesday, January the 22nd. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. After 5, with the presidential primary season in full swing, Ben and his guest will look at the words of the candidates and compare them to the campaign of 1968. Talking with a professor of communication at UW-Whitewater, Dick Haven, about presidential speeches and candidate speeches after 5 o'clock. Right now, we are talking about virtual schools with Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Today, or I should say tomorrow, the State Assembly, an Assembly committee, will vote on a bill that would affect virtual schools in Wisconsin. There is a competing bill in the State Senate that does something totally different with virtual schools. We're wondering about the debate over virtual schools and which side makes the most sense, which doesn't, and welcoming your thoughts and questions. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The Assembly Committee on Education will vote tomorrow at 1 o'clock on AB 637, which supports virtual schools and would preserve virtual schools, the future of virtual schools in a court decision in doubt. An appeals court ruled in December that virtual schools in Wisconsin were violating state law. And now both the Assembly and the Senate are trying to do something about that. And I apologize, Professor Correa, because this is so confusing to me. I'm sure you explained it clearly enough for most of our listeners, but not for me, because I'm a little slow when it comes to this. The Assembly is, in essence, doing what the virtual schools want and what the parents who have students going to virtual schools want. Is that correct?
Yes, and I think one way to be able to look at this is that we have always, really as a nation, been very flexible with the delivery of instruction. Most of the listeners probably went to brick-and-mortar schools. I liked your introduction about shoveling and getting off. And, of course, the virtual school children are probably wearing their pajamas this morning. But there's nothing brand new about that. I think if we all think back, some of the younger listeners probably remember watching MASH on TV, and Radar took correspondence courses. Perhaps some of the older listeners maybe actually took some of those correspondence courses. Those were in the mail. This is just simply another alternative method of delivery. The big difference, though, is that, of course, technology allows this to be much more dynamic, much more exciting, video streaming, web conversations. The technology has allowed this to be more dynamic and immediate. Couple this with the growth of the homeschool movement, and in the year 2000 plus, as we are, you have a really viable medium that's no longer slightly under the radar screen as an alternative that sometimes people chuckle at. Oh, you got your accounting degree in the mail. Now we have something that is starting to have legitimacy and access. And, of course, everybody's probably heard of the University of Phoenix. That's, of course, we have lots of universities. This is just simply a version of this that's in the high school and the public schools. Now, the difference is that now we have schools that are strapped for funding. We have teachers' unions that feel, probably rightly so, that they're under attack. And then this method of delivery becomes really politically charged. So the result is these two bills that are now in the legislative branch of the state of Wisconsin. And again, the Senate bill tries to define that, no, virtual schools cannot get this funding from all the way across the state. They can get perhaps half that funding, 50% of that student's money. And it also puts much more defined expectations for teacher involvement and those kind of things. In essence, it makes the virtual school a very close to the student physically opportunity. The Assembly bill is more innovative in that it recognizes the changes in technology, the fact that perhaps in the future more and more people are going to be doing this, which evidence does show that. Around Wisconsin, there may be 20,000 students or more in one way or another taking an online course, not necessarily the entire experience. And the Assembly bill really says, if we want these things to thrive and we want to be innovative, we have to make it possible for the financial reality and for this method of delivery. So that's why we have two opposite ways to do this. It also might be interesting in the fact that we have two houses that are both controlled by different political parties. Sure. So we have to include that politics in this too.
Yeah, so if nothing happens, the virtual schools would have to shut down?
As they currently operate, yes, although probably not shut down, but they would certainly operate very, very differently. One of the things that people aren't, that's kind of hard to understand about this, believe me, very hard to understand, is virtual schools are not a huge cash cow for local districts. Recently, the superintendent of the Appleton Schools, he issued a press release that said, after all expenses, the Appleton Virtual School made slightly over $20,000 for the district. That is not a cash cow. That won't even pay for a teacher's aide. But they do see that as a necessary service. But districts have so much startup costs between technology at both ends, delivery and distribution, and course development and on, that they have to recoup these costs, or it's just not political, or it's not financially viable.
Yeah. Well, but, so I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's fine. I was just going to say so schools are constrained in that they can't operate this at a loss, especially in this environment of funding and those other kind of issues. Previous shows, I know we've discussed the school funding formula. Well, here we have another interesting wrinkle in this.
Right.
So,
well, in fact, Saul from Stevens Point emailed a number of questions that I hope we can get to before our news break. One of them was, what is the rationale for maintaining the same level of funding since virtual schools do not support ancillary programs, including building security, the same proportion of teachers' salaries, physical and instructional disability accommodations, etc.?
And although, actually, let me, I think Saul asks a very, very good question, and I'm not here to argue for virtual schools, but to take the latter part of his question, actually, virtual schools do provide support with students with special needs.
Okay.
So there are some people involved that are speech and language pathologists or instructors and special needs instructors. So those people are involved because some students with special needs, especially in rural areas, find this much more agreeable than the long transport, et cetera. However, the other question is true. You know, you don't need to clean the bathroom, so to speak, at a virtual school. And there, so the cost structure is different, I would say. The problem is that right now the legislature has been very slow to respond to the reality of this delivery and this new technology. So they're just simply taking the existing structure and saying, okay, within this financial structure, we can afford to do X, Y, and Z. And so they're just simply operating within that. Again, we have to catch up with laws and regulations and statutes with what the school districts have said, here's the reality, we're going to do it. And DPI has not offered a lot of guidance to school districts, so they've just charged ahead and delivered this instruction, being on the front line, so to speak.
Yeah. Do you know, Professor Correa, Saul wonders, how much money per student is given by the state and how that compares with the monies students get in their district? I'm not sure I understand that.
Sure, yeah. That's a really good question. It appears that the average is somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 per student in a virtual school. So, you know, we take the pot of money, and we give each student X amount, theoretically, and then districts are funded by, you know, little Zachary's $5,500, say, and he goes to school there. Well, that money then would just simply be transferred if my son would go to Wisconsin Rapids High School, and now he's going to go to the Jedi Academy.
Okay.
I love that name. And then he would be able to take that $5,500, and that would fund the Jedi Academy.
We will check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking about the debate over virtual schools in Wisconsin. Our guest is Steve Correa, an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, talking about this because an assembly committee will vote on a bill dealing with virtual schools tomorrow. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 636 on this Tuesday, January the 22nd. We're talking about virtual schools in Wisconsin, virtual schools that instruct K through 12. Tomorrow, an assembly committee will be taking up legislation that deals with virtual schools. Last week, hundreds of kids and parents who support virtual schools rallied at the state capitol to back this assembly bill that would let their schools keep operating the way they do now. There is also a bill in the state Senate that had a public hearing last week that would take a different approach with virtual schools. The Senate bill would reduce funding to virtual schools. Both measures came up in response to a recent appeals court ruling that found Wisconsin's virtual schools were violating state laws. We are talking with an education professor about the debate over virtual schools and what the Assembly and the Senate are doing in terms of this legislation. and which approach makes the most sense. We are welcoming your questions and comments on what you think Wisconsin should do in terms of these virtual schools, these internet-based schools that teach K through 12 in Wisconsin. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Steve Correa. He is an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. And finishing off on Sol and Stephen's points, emailed questions, Professor Correa, how do virtual schools differ from homeschools?
Well, homeschools and the parents of homeschooled children have always struggled with access to really reliable, well-developed curriculum. And what this does is this takes this off the table. This makes this, oh, this is uneven, gee, this is a good place. The cultural literacy people or core knowledge is a good place to go for this, and et cetera, et cetera. What this does is this provides to them a ready-made, well-developed, developmentally appropriate, we can come up with lots more description, strong curriculum that can be delivered over the net, as the case may be with this. And it's wonderful for them because all the unevenness of other curricula now disappear. What the court ruled, and why this is why this is so significant, is that, again, it might have been a curriculum developed, but the court found no evidence that the actual instruction was taking place with teachers. This is the court ruling. And therefore, then the court ruled that the parents who are not licensed or the home caregiver were actually the ones that were being the instruction or the instructors.
So there's no teacher standing in some video internet thing saying, okay, now spell cat. And you don't have a teacher there telling the students what to do or teaching over the internet. You just have some curriculum.
Sure. Well, kind of. Again, it's delivered very different ways from some districts. Some districts do have a full, in fact, often during the course of the day, do have teachers readily available. If anybody's listening that does IM instant messaging, you get instant responses back, and they expect that. And now, maybe not at 8 o'clock at night. However, some districts do that. They have people log on at different times, you know, that are certified and whatnot. But other districts do not do that. So it's an uneven application. But again, anybody that has been in public schools knows that sometimes that person in front of the room is not teaching either. But nonetheless, the courts can only rule on what the statutes say. So one of the what the court said was that, again, as in most cases, the legislative branch is responsible to be able to change the law. What the court simply did is rule on the statutes that exist as is.
And that statute says you need a licensed teacher instructing.
They found that there was not strong evidence, you know, that actually the other way to say it, they found that the parents were the primary instructors, but the curriculum came from the district.
I get it. Go to Casey now in New London. Hi, Casey.
Hi. I would just like to say that there should be caution used in comparing virtual schools to University of Phoenix, because as a student at Phoenix, the majority of my courses are held on campus. I mean, the course material is online and whatnot, but I do go to class.
Professor Correa?
And I think she brings up a very good course, or a very good example. You know, there's even Lakeland University has a program called Blend Ed that has a version of access, campus access, and then you take some components of it online. So I really think what people are looking for, I think the concept here is flexibility and strong programming. And so the caller's absolutely correct. But some virtual schools, and my hunch would be in the long run, they're going to end up coming up with district wide consortiums that sort of are regionally based that might be able to deal with this funding issue. Virtual schools are a reality. This, you know, I don't like this analogy, but the genie's out of the box or the bottle. This is going to continue to be done. I think what needs to be done is they need to find a way to have it work within either existing statutes or new statutes. But the caller is exactly correct. I think I was using University of Phoenix as a viable for-profit national example of this type of option of delivery instruction. But again, Phoenix offers lots of permutations, and in many places it has a fine reputation.
Thanks, Casey. Elaine in Sheboygan is with us now. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Okay, I have 2 points. First of all, I really take offense to the comment that your guest made that homeschoolers have struggled with getting good curriculum, because I've been a homeschooler for over 20 years, and that's just not my experience at all. And my second point is virtual schools are very different from homeschools. A homeschool, you come under different regulations. You're considered a private school. You fund it completely yourself, and you have complete say over your curriculum. A virtual school, you have no say over the curriculum. It's completely funded by the public school. It's a totally different thing. It's a totally different entity, and most homeschoolers do not want to be virtual schoolers. And I'll take my your comments off the air. Thanks.
Again, this wasn't supposed to be a debate between virtual schools and homeschools.
Oh, sure, yeah. But I think she brings up a very good point. I'll start with the latter one first. What is the attraction for people that are thinking about homeschooling is virtual schools provide a ready-made access. In other words, the parents don't have to go to huge extremes to be able to do this. They don't have to tap into existing networks, et cetera, et cetera, especially for some of the more rural areas. I think this caller's from Sheboygan, and that's just great, but there's a little bit more access there than one may have in the Great North Woods or in other parts of Wisconsin or, frankly, nationally. So virtual schools allow them to be able to tap into this market and then still keep their children at home, which is something that they would think would be important. I would also say that while some at-home schools are comfortable with their curriculum, they are at best uneven, and still a lot of parents are always looking for, even the best of teachers, they're always looking for new things, and virtual schools provide that option for them to be able to access that. Not all, and if this person is able to do that, more power to them. But it is a struggle for a lot of parents that school at home.
Yeah. But again, she was right, too, when she said the virtual schools are funded by the public schools.
Yes, virtual schools, it's a public entity. And so she's exactly right. There are a lot of parents at home that homeschool that don't want anything to do with virtual schools. You know, their rationale for homeschooling is to not be influenced by the public schools. Mm-hmm. But again, for others, this provides them some flexibility. So, you know, we're dealing with a wide swath of people that use the public schools. So there's all different kind of, constituencies out there.
We're talking with Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, talking about the debate over the funding of virtual schools and the legality of virtual schools. There was an appeals court ruling in December that said that virtual schools in Wisconsin were violating state law. The State Assembly and the State Senate have responded with different legislation, and we are talking about the differences in those two bills and the future of virtual schools and the concept of virtual schools. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 7, President Bush and Republicans in Congress think that giving a tax rebate to most of us would help the economy, but they are saying that a tax rebate check should only go to those who actually paid income taxes and not to millions of low-income people who paid little or no taxes, income taxes last year. Democrats have a different idea. We will talk about that debate coming up after 7 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about the debate going on over virtual schools in Wisconsin with our guest professor of education, and welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The Assembly Committee on Education will hold a vote tomorrow on AB 637, which supports and would preserve virtual schools the way they are operating right now. There is a different bill in the state Senate that would change things, that the parents who send their kids to virtual schools aren't very happy about. Mary in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When my daughter was 10 years old, she broke her leg, and she wasn't able to attend regular public school for 12 weeks. The school sent a certified teacher to the house twice a week. All she did was give me the curriculum for that week or for those few days and told me to go through it with my daughter. When my daughter returned to school 12 weeks later, she was 3 weeks ahead of her class. And it really made me seriously think about public education from that point going forward and how I addressed my daughter's education and how I interacted with her. And if I hadn't been working full-time, you know, a lot of ifs in life, but I think at that point, if I had had the option, I would have taken her out of public school and chosen that option.
Yeah, what do you think of virtual schools?
I think that they're an excellent option. I'm enrolled in essentially a master's program through UW-Milwaukee. It's a virtual school. I watch my classes online. I have a instant chat with my professors, and I think it's great.
Yeah. Do you think the state should be funding kids going to virtual schools pretty much the same way they are with kids that go to a brick-and-mortar school?
Yes.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of wasted energy in public schools, and until the system changes, I think that parents should have intelligent options with their children.
Yeah. Professor Correa, what about that? Is this an intelligent option?
Well, I think try to think back to ancient Greece. I have a feeling somebody wrote Plato a letter and asked him if these lectures were available on paper.
Mm-hmm.
We always want flexibility. That's mm-hmm. what people want. And, of course, every commercial, every television show shows us that's something we should want. The caller, though, speaks to really sort of a slightly different issue. It's what one feels like they want to extract from the experience of being in public schools. One of the criticisms of at-home schooling has been, now whether it's legitimate or not, it's one of the criticisms, is that social dynamic, that idea of being with people that are alike and unlike you, people that are different, people that think differently, that whole social cultural dynamic of public schools. But the reality is that virtual schools are here, and a lot of parents find that they can direct and control and pace at a way that matches their individual students' needs. So that option is available, and knowledgeable parents like options. Now, of course, our caller also talks about the reality of having to work. This isn't one that works for everybody, but it is one that I think is going to have to remain. It's just going to be up to the legislature to try to help to deal with these funding issues, which are ongoing and never easily satisfied.
So help me understand the teachers' union's beef with the virtual schools, the way they are operating now and how they are funded now. They think that this is taking away the funding that they could have for their brick-and-mortar schools and their teachers in those schools?
I think that's the short version is yes. The idea is that that WEAC, and of course this is nationally,
mm-hmm.
see this as a way to undermine teachers and teacher professionalism and teacher-directed instruction, because it's all often you're not still positive, what's going on, as teachers would argue, at the other end of that computer.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea then is this is yet another avenue to siphon off teacher professionalism and perhaps even union members. And we must not forget, WEAC
does represent the professional and employment mm-hmm. opportunities and directions of teachers. So they see this as a threat to that. And then, of course, they bundle that, properly so, with concerns about the legitimate instruction and learning of students. However, I personally know many members of WEAC who do teach in virtual schools, mm-hmm. and they are very confident in the quality of instruction. But WEAC went this direction, and of course the appeals court ruled in their favor that there were lots of issues here, including whether or not certified teachers were really delivering the instruction.
John in Gordon is with us now. Hi, John.
Good morning, Joy. A few things about virtual schools. First of all, a virtual school is virtually a school. It's not really a school. I don't have any problem with the idea of delivering instruction on a temporary basis to kids who are homebound for some particularly unique reason. However, the concept of having a virtual school year-round for people who would like to keep their children at home is a big problem as far as I'm concerned. I live up here in the North Woods, and one of the dirty little secrets about homeschooling is that there are some people who like to keep their kids living in a trailer way back in the woods somewhere so they can abuse them in private.
Well. I don't know if that's really linked to our discussion or not. Does, Professor Correa, do you have any?
I think, though, that the caller does bring up one thing, and really, we've always looked at public schools. I mean, gosh, this goes back to John Dewey and Colonel Parker and all of these wonderful people as the pot in which the melting occurs. And this doesn't happen in this way. So, but. No, he also does bring up a good point in that, you know, there are lots of students that do take courses. And by the way, math is the most popular kind of online course to take nationally, even for high school students, that can pick up deficient credits. So I think it's the extent of the option of non-traditional delivery schooling that we're looking at. Now, this is an extreme case, and there might be some of those. I'd also assure the caller that children can be abused after going to school and staying at home.
Yeah.
So it's a serious issue no matter what, but perhaps this is important.
Next, we go to Jack in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Actually, it's Chad. But my question is, or I think the challenge I see with virtual schools is the testing portion where really, the only option is open book tests because, somebody on the other side of the computer, you don't know whether they're using a book or not, unless you institute some kind of testing center. Yeah. And I'll just take my question off the air.
All right.
I like Dubuque, by the way, beautiful city.
Mm-hmm.
These things can be issued or can be done well. They can be timed. There's technology to allow a quiz to be opened and closed at a certain time. Probably not too many teachers actually have a problem with open book tests. Of course, if I'm a student, I don't frankly want one because that means anything is available to me. But there are ways to legitimize this. I know realtors and appraisers have to take tests and there that are off-site. So there are ways to do that are quite legitimate and quite protected. But again, it's another step that has to take place. So very true.
Now our phones are going crazy with callers. An email from Dan in Appleton. It seems this debate is about money. My question that doesn't seem to be addressed yet is, what is the purpose of our tax money for education? I would suggest that our taxes are not provided as a way to fund teachers' salaries and local buildings, but to educate our young. If this approach is not adequately educating our young, this approach meaning virtual schools, as it should through ACT, SAT scores of graduates, then pull the plug. But if this is a viable option to effectively educate the young, then pursue it and allow it to grow. Your reaction?
I think he brings up a good point. This is about money.
Mm-hmm.
And this also, though, is about a tax on the existing delivery of instruction and, you know, teacher unions. So this is a two-pronged attack. Districts have been very innovative, particularly Appleton, Janesville, other areas. They've been very innovative at looking at alternate ways to deliver instruction and to keep a cash flow. That's very, very important. Evidence shows, though, that there's very little to no difference in quality of test scores between at-home school children and students at the public schools. Again, the difference is, what else do we want our public schools to do, and children that are funded with public education, that add-on value of a democratic society? And that is a component that one may argue might not be a component of the virtual schools.
Yeah. In our final minute, I'll make you put your political scientist hat on again, even though I know you're not a political scientist. Is one of these bills going to win out over the other, do you think?
My bet is, and I was a little surprised that this was up for a vote already. This seems more quick than we invaded Iraq. And this is complex stuff. My bet is that districts are going to be able to form some type of regional consortium. And then, through that forum, instruction would be delivered virtually to some district's agreement, so that we're not out of district. So almost super districts, maybe within the CSIS. I'm not quite sure, but that may be the forum.
Yeah. And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, very glad. Thank you.
Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. Thanks to Leo Duran and Karen Prager for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.